You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Sephora's biggest sale of the year is on. Get 20% off the best gifts, including makeup from brands like Rare Beauty.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
20% off skincare from brands like Glow Recipe and Summer Fridays.
These are my fave.
20% off hair care like Way and K18.
I'm obsessed.
And 20% off fragrances like Valentino, Donna, Born, and Roma.
Mm. So good.
20% off your purchase now through December 15th. Shop now at Sephora and Sephora at Kohl's.
What if you could hear your favorite song for the first time again? Introducing the all-new, reimagined Nissan Kicks. With an available Bose Personal Plus sound system that uses speakers in the headrest to create a 360-degree listening experience. You've never heard anything like this. Reimagine your music and your drive. Experience the all-new reimagined Nissan Kicks for yourself at NissanUSA.com today.
Available feature. Bose is a registered trademark of the Bose Corporation.
What if the invisible gases all around us were made visible?
If we could see gases now looking around us, like we would see that over there, there's a bit more carbon dioxide, and over there there's a bit more nitrogen.
What we can't see can still have a big effect. The atmosphere, for example, comprises many invisible gases. Their weight presses down on us, but we are used to atmospheric pressure, so we don't notice it. But if those gases disappeared...
Because we've got internal pressure on our bodies that is equal and opposite to the pressure from the atmosphere, that would lead to an imbalance that would probably mean that we basically explode, which is an unpleasant way to go.
Gases fill our lungs, power the stars, and cause marquee signs to glow. How would we ever find a good diner without flashing neon? Because we can't see these gases, we probably don't spend much time thinking about them. One material scientist wants to change that by sharing the secret life of these invisible substances. I'm Seth Shostak, and this is Big Picture Science from the SETI Institute.
I'm Molly Bentley, and in this episode, find out why a tour that takes us from hydrogen to carbon dioxide to steam, yes, steam, is a real gas.
When we spoke with material scientist Mark Miodubnik for our recent episode about the periodic table, he explained why the table is ordered in rows and columns and why some of the elements are gases.
So it's the weight is a really big clue. Like, different atoms have different weights. And the idea is then, okay, well, maybe the light elements, the ones that don't weigh very much, maybe they're just gases. And that turns out to be true. The lightest element is hydrogen. And the second lightest element is helium, and they are light, right? And they, in fact, will just, you know, very low density. But then, oh no, the next one is lithium, and that's a metal on Earth at room temperature. So that then goes on. But there are other gases that are heavier than that. But why? So why is lithium a metal? So then the periodic table comes along, a guy called Mendeleev, but there were loads of other people fiddling around with this at the time. Basically saying, look, it's not just the weight that's important. It's something about the number of protons, so that the atoms themselves have an inner structure, and they're made of protons and electrons and neutrons. And the number of protons in the nucleus, which is the kind of heavy bit of an atom, that turns out to be the thing that defines quite a lot about how the atom reacts with the rest of the world, how it is in its chemistry. And so that is why the periodic table ends up being arranged the way it is.
That is, arranged by atomic number, the number of protons in their nuclei. When we refer to an element as a gas, by the way, we are usually considering its state at room temperature and pressure.
Dr. Miodubnik has more to say about gases than we could fit in our earlier episode, so we wanted to give him room to expand on gases in this one. A professor of materials and society at the University of College London, he is the author of a book that looks at how gases from individual elements to compounds have shaped human history. It's called It's a Gas.
He begins with that first entry in the periodic table, the lightest and most abundant gas in the universe, hydrogen. He describes how a scientist determined that it is the principal component of stars.
Well, yeah, this is a really amazing story because, you know, no one's been to the sun, right? So how are we so sure about this? But we're dead sure.
Or return to talk about it.
But... Yeah, or return to talk about it. Yeah, but we're dead sure, right? So, you know, humans are clever, you know, but they've been clever for a long time, but they just didn't have the right tools to ask that kind of question and get the answer. But on Earth, hydrogen doesn't really appear on its own very often because it's so reactive that it constantly reacts with everything else before you get to it. So, you know, you come across hydrogen in the form of water, like water is H2O, but you don't experience the hydrogen, you experience the water. So if you can look at early curious humans are thinking, well, I mean, they have no idea that hydrogen exists in its pure form as a gas. But then as we kind of get better at kind of understanding that there are these different elements in the world, then you start to realize, okay, well, hold on a minute. What is water made of? And so they found ways of splitting it apart and splitting other compounds apart. And this one gas, hydrogen, kept popping up. And it had particular properties. Like if you put a lit flame near this gas... in the presence of air, it will explode. And so had a very good, in the early days, a very good way of saying, okay, I've produced hydrogen, I've managed to get it out of water or out of some other compound, and I've now isolated it as this gas in this container, let's say. But then, okay, well, that's just a kind of, we think it's this gas, but you can't see it, it's invisible. You can't taste it, it's tasteless. You can't feel it. So gases have always been this really difficult form of matter to get your head around. But here's the thing that happens with spectroscopy. When you put a flame on it, you get some light and you can measure that light. You can measure the wavelength of that light. You can look at it through these different lenses and spectrometers, and that then divides it up into different wavelengths of light. And you get a fingerprint of that atom. So if you can think of all the elements, when you heat them up, they give off light. And they have these kind of light fingerprints that you can detect, and they're unique. So once measured hydrogen on Earth, right, you know it's hydrogen, you got it out of this compound, you've now measured its fingerprint in form of light, and now you look at the sun and you think, hey, I wonder what's in the sun. Let's look at the light coming from the sun and see if any of the fingerprints on Earth match the ones in the sun. And lo and behold, you get that the sun is full of hydrogen.
The point that you make in your book, It's a Gas, is that gases are everywhere. And you said this about hydrogen. How do you measure it? How do you identify it? It is invisible. It doesn't have an odor. But this is one of the reasons that you write that we sometimes don't pay attention to gases. And if we did, if we paid more attention to gases in general, as you do, as a scientist, and as you describe in your book, what would we notice? Like, how would the world change if suddenly we were aware that gases are everywhere?
Yeah, I think the first thing you would notice, it would feel more like being underwater. So, you know, if you've ever been snorkeling or scuba diving, or been at the bottom of the sea, looking around at all the fish and, you know, corals and everything like that, you are aware that you're in a fluid. You can see it, and you can see it changes color and has different densities in certain places and different depths, right? So that if we could see gases, we would see that now looking around us, right? We would see that over there, oh, there's a bit more carbon dioxide, and over there there's a bit more nitrogen, and oh my goodness, up there near there there's high pressure, and over there there's low pressure. So we actually need tools, very sophisticated tools, to detect those different aspects of the atmosphere, because we don't have the sensors that allow us to do that. We can't sense low pressure, high pressure. But actually, I think you would if you could see gases. And you would be able to say, oh, there's a lovely bit of air, I'm going to breathe it over there. In the same way that you can see a lovely clear water in a pond, and you can see very opaque water in a muddy pond, right? And, you know, one of the things we worry about these days is the quality of our air in our cities. If we could see the nitrous oxide that is being given out by cars and by other industries, we would probably run away and avoid it. In fact, we probably wouldn't put up with living in cities with cars, because we would be breathing in what we would perceive to be dirty air.
Let's talk more about the atmosphere, because that's a great description of what it's like to be a creature living with this atmospheric pressure. If it went away, let's just say that we could continue breathing, so this is a thought experiment only. If it went away, how would our bodies feel if there were no atmosphere, if the no atmospheric pressure because the atmosphere went away.
Yeah, so I mean, I think you're talking really about like being in space. So we become weightless in that sense. Actually, would we become weightless? No, we still have gravity on us. No, this is a good question. Sorry, it's not like being in space. We wouldn't have this pressure pushing down on us, but we'd still have gravity. I think we'd bulge out, actually, wouldn't we? Because, yeah, we would bulge out like a balloon. I think that's what would happen. Because we'd be still stuck to the Earth's surface, but we wouldn't have this pressure of the air keeping us in. And, oh, yeah, I know, because, in fact, if you put things in a vacuum that... I'm thinking of things like you can basically put things in a vacuum, and what they end up doing, because they haven't got air pressure on them, they expand outwards. So, yeah, I'm pretty sure that our skin and our bodies would kind of plump out. And probably that would result in... Because we've got internal pressure on our bodies that is equal and opposite to the pressure from the atmosphere... That would lead to an imbalance that would probably mean that we basically explode, which is an unpleasant way to go.
It is really fun to listen to you think this thought experiment through. That was really a treat. You know, so we're not aware of this atmospheric pressure holding us together. Another question about the atmosphere. So many elements are in the atmosphere. So you have nitrogen, we have oxygen, we have carbon dioxide, which is a compound of elements. But there's also neon in the mix, which I was surprised to learn. So when we're breathing that precious oxygen, we're also taking in a little bit of neon. How did neon become one of the, and is it essential? Like, could the neon go away and we'd still be fine? But what is neon doing in our breathable air?
Yeah, we're breathing neon every breath, and we should be thrilled, in my view. we're breathing argon and krypton and xenon as well, all in smaller proportions, argon the most, neon probably the next amount. So we don't need to be concerned about breathing in neon because it's a noble gas, so-called, because it doesn't really react with anything. So if you think of the deleterious effects of how some atoms... or molecules react with our cells and our physiology and cause us illness, you know, in our lungs or in our liver or kidney, you know, like alcohol, the molecule alcohol, or breathing in the nitric oxides or really poisonous gases like chlorine. Those interact very strongly with our physiology, and you really don't want to be breathing those. But neon doesn't interact at all. It doesn't react with anything. And we breathe it out in the next breath. So it's a kind of passenger in the air, a rather thrilling passenger, because when we finally discovered it, and it was very hard to discover because it's a gas, it's invisible, can't see it, can't smell it, can't taste it, doesn't react with anything, so no compounds of neon either. So you can't use chemistry to get it out. But once we discovered it and isolated it and put electricity through it, you get this incredible neon light. And that, you know, that's one of those sort of presents that the universe gives us, isn't it? You know, this sort of really exotic element in every breath we take, and it has this secret, and the secret is that it will give off this incredible light if you do the right things to it.
As you said, neon in its natural state is colorless and it's odorless. We don't think of neon as colorless. How do you isolate neon and enough of it to put it into... This is a really naive question, but I it's a genuine one. How do you isolate a gas like neon and then put it into a bottle, and then so you can run that electricity through it and, you know, light up your beautiful neon sign? How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, and that's why it took us so long, because it's really tricky. And it took us so long to get there because, A, we had no idea it was there. B... Once you know it's there, well, you can only know it there until you can isolate it. And isolating it, because it doesn't react with most things, you can't put a chemical reaction. So for instance, hydrogen. If you want to get some hydrogen, react it with oxygen, then you've got water. So you've got hold of it easy. You know, you can put it in a bottle. if you want to get neon, it doesn't react with anything. So the way you get neon is you cool the air down. And as you cool the air down, and this is what I was talking about, this is why I was quite particular about what temperature you're talking about the gases, because as you cool things down, they turn from a gas into a liquid, and then usually into a solid. And so temperature changes the state of the air. and you can liquefy air. And so you turn air with its constituents, which is nitrogen, oxygen, water, neon, argon, and all the other trace elements, into this liquid. Okay, it's still a liquid, it's still a mixture, so you're no closer. But that's the genius of a guy called William Ramsay, who was a professor here of chemistry at my university where I am, University College London. His genius was to go, okay, well, look, if we now heat up that liquid, they won't all become gases again at the same time. Actually, the ones that are most volatile, so the ones that are least wanting to be a liquid, will come off first. And they're the ones that are the noble gases. So out come helium, and then out comes, so you collect that and you store that away, and then out come neon, and so on. So you basically liquefy air, and then you basically take off bits of each individual gas. So this is very like distillation of alcohol. Like if you want to make whiskey or any of these things, you're basically turning a liquid into a gas to take different fractions of it away and do things to it.
That is so interesting. So you really want to calibrate those temperatures.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and precisely.
So you have to have good cryogenics, is what this is called. Good cryogenic equipment. You have to have very precise thermometers. And then when you have isolated the gases and put them in a little glass vial, then they're there, right? Then they're there sort of forever, because they're not going to escape. And so that's when you put neon into a glass tube. You then can put electricity through it and it will light up, and you can know that's neon because you can see it from the light, and the light has a particular fingerprint. The spectroscopy of it tells you it's neon. And then you can look in the sun and you say, well, is there neon in the sun? And the answer is yes.
My next question is about that. But because you have said colorless, invisible, odorless, when you describe, I think, every gas that we've talked about so far, is that something that all gases that are elements have in common? I mean, are there any elements that are gases at room temperature that give off an odor, or that have a color? Are they all invisible?
No, chlorine has a color. There are gases with colors, and some of the colors are very faint. So most of the colored gases are molecules. So that's two atoms bonded together. In the case of chlorine, it's two chlorine atoms, and it's got a yellow-green color. It's quite faint, and you don't really want to see it with your naked eye, because that means you're in contact with it, and it's going to poison you. It's toxic, and it was the first chemical warfare gas. But things like the nitrous oxides, they're also coloured. They're sort of a slightly brown colour. You can see it very faintly, and you can often see it when you look at smog in a city. If you're far away on a hillside, you look over a city, you'll see that the gases that come off automotive, a lot of cars, when it all collects, is a kind of hazy brown colour. And that's the nitric oxides. And what else has a colour? Not very many. Yeah, no, there aren't many very, very coloured gases that you can see. It's true.
Coming up, you may think you're well acquainted with water in its gaseous state from sitting in saunas and steeping cups of tea. But what steam is and what it's not may surprise you.
When you see a cloud coming out of a kettle, you know, if you're making a cup of tea or coffee, right, and you boil the kettle, and there's this smoky stuff is coming out of the kettle, right? That is not steam.
How the real steam kick-started the Industrial Revolution next. This episode of Big Picture Science is A Real Gas.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
Oh,
We're going full steam ahead in our discussion of gases. We'll soon hear why raising the temperature of water created the motive power for engines that drove the Industrial Revolution. But first, a bit more about the role of temperature. When we refer to gaseous elements like hydrogen and helium on the periodic table, we usually consider their properties at room temperature and pressure. Under those conditions, the table includes 11 gases. But the states of elements, solid, liquid, or gas, are mutable. So we asked material scientist Mark Miodovnik what temperature is required to turn all the elements into gases.
If you heat them all up, so imagine they all have a melting point, which is the temperature at which they go from a solid to a liquid, right? And they all have a boiling point. Well, almost all of them have a boiling point where they go from a liquid to a solid. Some of them go straight from a solid to a gas, and that's called subliming. But anyway, so I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. To answer your question, I need to know what is the one with the highest boiling point, because that will be the last one to go. I think it's carbon is something like 3,500. Is it subliming temperature or is it platinum? Anyway, one of those two is very high. But that's the kind of temperature range at which everything else is going to be a gas, and those ones are going to be the last ones to become gases.
Can you say that temperature again? Did you say 3,000?
Yeah, 3,500, I think. Is the
Celsius or Fahrenheit?
Celsius.
Although it doesn't really matter.
At that point, it doesn't matter, yeah.
So, wow.
Yeah, I can look it up if you want me to. Oh, no, it's more. It's 4,800. Anyway, so its boiling point is 4,827 carbon. So, you know, if you get up to 5,000, I'm sure you're into this territory where, to answer your question, everything is going to become a gas. And what happens is that as you go into space and stars, of course, all of them in the stars, it's much hotter. And so they're all in that gas state. In fact, they're in a sort of plasma state, so-called, because, and this is maybe a bit annoying, but there is a state of matter called plasma, which is even hotter, let's say, than a gas state. And it's a different state of matter because you've taken the protons and you've separated from the electrons. So the proton nucleus of the elements is sort of floating around without its electrons.
My goodness. Okay, so there's no doubt that the universe has been or can be that hot, or certainly was that hot at one time, and certainly around stars you reach some of those temperatures.
Yeah, that's the temperature of the sun and the stars, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 degrees, you know, average temperature. And so everything in the sun, there's no solid in the sun, there's no liquid in the sun, it's all gas and plasma, right? And so when we talk about the solid liquid part of the universe is a rare bit of the universe. Like most of the universe is sort of gases and plasmas, right? We're standing on one of the few bits that's not that, that's cooler than that. And those are called the planets and asteroids and comets and things. And so when things get cooler, then suddenly the liquid and the gas exist at the same time, and then they get cooler and the solids exist. So the Earth started out as a ball of, coalesced as a gas, and then it became a liquid, and then it became had a solid crust, and it's still got liquid on the inside. We live on the solid crust of the Earth, and of course we have an atmosphere, which is the gas phase, and we've only recently, because it's invisible, so we only recently worked out how complex that atmosphere is, and also, as I say in the book, how the evolution of the atmosphere is absolutely connected to the evolution of life on Earth. They are connected absolutely in synchronous. So much so that there's a whole theory which is that the Earth itself is a kind of living organism. It's called Gaia, this theory, because you can't have life on Earth unless the planet itself makes the conditions possible for life, and yet life itself creates the atmosphere. So there's a feedback loop between the whole Earth and its atmosphere and life. And that's constantly going on. So that is rather marvelous and wonderful and kind of awesome, really, you know, truly awesome.
We've been talking about elements that exist as gases at room temperature, but there's one compound, of course, that you've mentioned that is made up of two elements, which is oxygen and hydrogen. So obviously that's water. And you talk about steam as a gas. And I have to admit, I had to stop and think about that because I think of steam as a whole collection of water molecules or water droplets. I don't think of steam as a gas. Is that just my own, you know, my poor science education?
No, it's not about poor anything.
It's confounding.
The universe is a confusing place. And actually trying to work out how it all works, I mean, obviously that's the job of science, but none of it is common sense, right? So it's not, there's no critique there. And it is wonderful when you finally get, you know, you understand these things. So when you see a cloud of, you know, a cloud coming out of a kettle, you know, if you're making a cup of tea or coffee, right, and you boil the kettle and there's these, this smoky stuff is coming out of the kettle, right? That is not steam. That is what you said. That is like a cloud. That is loads of little water droplets, which are a cloud. And the, you know that's true because why is it white? Steam is invisible, tasteless, and you can't feel it. So what are you seeing? You're seeing a cloud. You've made a cloud. How have you made a cloud? Well, you've basically evaporated a lot of water and it's coming out of the spout of the kettle. And then it suddenly cools down into liquid water. And the tiny droplets, and they refract the light, and so the light coming from any light source in the room hits those droplets and comes off towards your eye, and so you see them as white, just like if it's a white source, just like the clouds are white. And so you've made a cloud. It is full of tiny droplets of water and it's not steam. But it was formed through steam, which you couldn't see. And if you would put your hand in front of the spout, or look at the spout, don't put your hand in front of that. Do not put your hand. What you'll find is there's an invisible gas coming out, which is steam. And these are water molecules that are just completely a gas, right? They're not liquid, they are not bonded to other liquid molecules. They're a gas. And that is the gas state of liquid or of water. And they are invisible, but they are incredibly powerful. And that the power of that steam is what started the industrial age on this planet. And it is quite an amazing story, really an incredible story.
You write that steam allowed for our first gas-powered technology. So I wonder, Mark, if you could explain what engineering breakthrough made steam power possible. And I believe this is in the 17th century, so somewhere around 1670, thereabouts. What did we understand about that heating up of water that could provide ultimately an engine, but that could power machines?
Yeah, I mean, it is an incredible story. So for thousands of years, people understood that steam was powerful, and the kind of using a jet of steam, we're talking about a jet of steam coming out of a kettle. But imagine you put that on an object that's free to move, let's say a boat. You know, can you get that jet of steam to move it in one direction? The answer, you can, yes. Is it powerful? No. Does it cost you a lot of energy? Yes. You know, could it compete against wind power of sails? No. So basically, people played around with it for thousands of years, trying to get steam to be useful like that, and couldn't really get anywhere. The real insight that made the steam power possible and the whole machine age possible was that when steam comes out as a gas into a container, and it fills that container, it will stop, it basically counteracts atmospheric pressure. So there's a balance between the pressure of the steam inside the container and the pressure outside, which is the atmospheric pressure of the whole atmosphere pressing down. And the steam will basically balance itself and become atmospheric pressure. So the two balance each other. But then if you cool the inside of this cylinder, the steam will become water almost instantaneously because it's cool there now. It's not above 100 degrees. And so there's nothing inside that cylinder anymore. It's a vacuum. Now, that happens almost instantaneously, and the power of the vacuum is the power of the whole atmosphere pressing down on it. And it's actually big.
So just to be clear, because when it's in steam form, it's taking up more space, it's taking up more volume because it's hot and the atoms are very excited. And then when it cools down, it condenses very quickly, as you described. And now you have this liquid, but then you have all this other space that used to be these atoms bouncing around.
Well, it's molecules.
But they are no longer.
Yeah.
Oh, it is molecules. You had these molecules... You had these molecules bouncing around, but now you don't. So now you have the vacuum.
It's got to do with the condensing. So the fact that it goes from, as you say, it changes volume by a thousandfold, and so there's a vacuum. And that, so it, well, in a way, what does that gain you? Anything? But this is the genius of Thomas Newcomen, who's the one who really puts the whole thing together. He says, well, if I put steam in a container and I put a lid on the container that can move, then when we condense the steam, the lid's going to be sucked down by the vacuum. well, basically pushed down by the atmosphere because there's nothing opposing it anymore. And then if I fill it with steam again, the lid will go back up again. So think of the lid now as a piston. It gets sucked down by the condensing, and then you add steam and it gets pulled back up again. Sucked down by the condensing, it gets pulled up back again. Sucked down by, and you have this back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and you get a, and that is the steam engine. And so it's understanding how to cool a cylinder and get that force, and then heat it up again and get the steam. And then the early steam engines were incredibly slow and incredibly sort of clunky, but they did that job. It's a very simple piece of thing. And you can imagine with that thing working, what you need is good seals and very good engineering to get all the cylinders right. And you need to be able to pump, you need to be able to make steam and pump it in and then turn it off with a valve at one point and then cool it down and then uncool it and turn the valve back. You know, so it's complicated, and that's why it took so long. But in the end, the steam engine is born and it starts to become useful. And then you see, once you have it like that, other inventors, other engineers look at it and go, huh, well, you can make something go up and down. Okay, can you make something go round and round? Answer, yes. Can you make a car? Could we make a form of transport? I mean, quite quickly, people are really trying to do something which was just going up and down and pumping water out of a mine, which was the first application, to, okay, maybe this is a form of transport. And that real inquisitiveness about humans, that urge to engineer something and understand the creativity of, you can see something's working, but you can do it better or you can do it differently. That's what's so incredible about the steam age, is that there's 1,000 engineers who all do something different with steam, and it creates all these different machines that completely transform the world.
But that's why on steam engines or steam locomotives, you needed to carry a bunch of things on board. You needed fuel, usually coal, to heat things up, to heat up the water. But then you also needed water to cool it down, to change the, you know, the composition, as you said, or the state of water. And that's why you write there were so many stops on the railways, because you'd have to stop often to get more water so you could keep that process going.
Yeah, you need water because the water was vented in those steamer, in the locomotives, they're vented, the water's not conserved, so it's vented out into the, and that's where the puff comes from. And so you're constantly puffing the water away, you're heating it up into steam, then you're condensing it, and then it puffs up the chimney. And so that's, yeah, as you say, that you need a constant source of water, and obviously you need a constant source of fuel, and without those two, you go in nowhere. And so you have to have stops on the way that have that. And in a way, it's the corollary is the kind of the modern gas station, and now with the age of the electric car, you know, you have to have these stops to recharge. So that's, you know, in some ways that problem never goes away. You always need a stop point for all these transport systems.
Gases are one of the three states of matter that we learn about in, I guess, middle school, right? Solid, liquid, and gas. And normally we don't think too much about the gases because, it's, you know, it's been pointed out, we can't see them very easily, if at all. And as a consequence, we sort of forget they're there. But the gases have been responsible in some way for some of the greatest changes to society that we've ever seen. And in particular, the Industrial Revolution was made possible because of the realization by Jim Watt that steam, which is a gas, could be used to power things.
Another gas, hydrogen, powers the sun.
The sun does run on hydrogen, that's right. That's because the sun is mostly hydrogen. Well, the universe is mostly hydrogen, as I think we've probably said a million times. 1/4 of the universe by weight is hydrogen. So there's a lot of hydrogen out there, and it powers the stars. And, you know, as a consequence, it'll probably power humanity in another 20 or 30 years. One of the atomic components of steam, that's hot H2O, is the O. But convincing 18th century minds that oxygen even existed was a challenge, preferring, as they did, the theory about a hypothetical combustible substance in the air called phlogiston.
the phlogiston theory had a lot of evidence behind it, and everyone believed it was true. So in order to disprove it, you had to have a lot of other evidence. And because most of it's invisible, you know, you have all sorts of problems persuading people.
Next, how we determine that oxygen is, but phlogiston is not, a real gas on Big Picture Science.
This is a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup sound experiment. We're looking to find the perfect way to hear Reese's so you'll buy more of them. Here we go. Reese's. Reese's.
Reese's.
Reese's.
Reese's. Hey, get out of here, you little stinker. Reese's.
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 Peanut Butter Cups.
That breathy one sounded very creepy, am I right?
There are a surprising number of songs that use the idea of oxygen to describe essential things like love or life itself. No substance other than water, which contains oxygen, is so essential to life.
So it's interesting from an historical perspective that when steam was harnessed as a power source in the late 17th century, it took many decades before scientists identified its components, hydrogen and oxygen. In other words, for a long time, engineers didn't know the chemical composition of the steam that made their machines go, including the gas that is essential to animal life.
But scientists did recognize that something in the air was combustible, yet they attributed the flammable property to a substance they called phlogiston. And the phlogiston theory was surprisingly long-lived, says material scientist Mark Miodovnik, nudging aside an acceptance of the element with atomic number 8, well into the 18th century.
Once again, you've got oxygen, which is a gas. It's very reactive, so it doesn't occur, well, it's in the air, but it's quite hard to know what it is because it constantly reacts with things. And the way that people were mostly familiar with that reaction was the thing that they called an element, called fire. It was very confusing. Like, you have this element, fire, and it's always associated with air. And they don't know that it's the oxygen in the air that's causing the fire. So here you have a candle flame. Why does a candle burn? Well, their theory was there's this thing called phlogiston, a material stuff. And the candle had phlogiston in it. And that, when you started a flame, the phlogiston was given out. And that's what you saw as the brightness of a flame. And it went into the air. And then plants sucked down the phlogiston. And that's why wood burned, because it had the phlogiston in it. And it's why rocks didn't burn, because they didn't have phlogiston in it. So they had this theory of why fires worked and candles worked, but it was wrong. But because it was wrong, they kind of weren't looking for the almost the opposite of that, which is that the reason why a candle burns is because there's oxygen, a gas, invisible, tasteless, smellless, but it's in the air. And when it reacts chemically, so it's a chemical reaction with the vapor of a candle, or the kind of vapor of a piece of wood, then you get this chemical reaction that's so strong it creates a very hot gas. So a flame is a hot gas, and it's caused by chemical reaction with oxygen. So it's actually a very complicated thing to get your head around, and of course it took them a while to understand that. And it was only really when a guy called Joseph Priestley, you know, started doing some reactions and isolating gases that the idea of so-called dephlogistonated air came possible to understand. And he rejected the idea that oxygen existed. He didn't believe it. He still wanted phlogiston to be the answer. But in the end, rationality prevailed. So oxygen, yeah, it's a really hard one to kind of understand, because it kind of, it's so reactive that when it reacts, you get this other phenomena, a flame, and that kind of distracts you, right? That seems to have substance. But actually, it's a hot gas.
And the thing about Priestley, and this is one of the themes running through your book, is that because gas is invisible, there's a lot of room there to deny that it exists. So you come up with other explanations for what's happening. And I think, in fact, you say that the explanation that scientists gave for if you were to burn a stack of wood in a confined space, let's say in a jar, after a certain amount of time, it would stop burning, they thought, because the wood contained only a certain amount of phlogiston, not because it was cut off from oxygen. So there was a whole other theory that just made sense, right? Because you could repeat these experiments and they seemed to be repeatable. And so that seemed to confirm the existence of this stuff.
You put it brilliantly. And I think this is the thing about science. So science is all about being self-consistent. So if you have a theory, then you can predict certain things would work. But when a theory like that predicts something and it comes to pass, well, then you have evidence that it's right. And so the phlogiston theory had a lot of evidence behind it, and everyone believed it was true. So in order to disprove it, you had to have a lot of other evidence. And because most of it's invisible, you know, you have all sorts of problems persuading people that it's the right theory. And actually water is a reaction between hydrogen and oxygen. And you have to actually do that. You actually have to get hydrogen gas and oxygen gas and react them together and go, look what comes out of it, water. And so, yeah, you have to connect a lot of different facts and turn over established facts. And that's of course, the problem we have today with climate change and the impact of the invisible gases in the atmosphere is that it's easy to deny because all the phenomena are complex and they're all invisible.
We should be grateful to oxygen. And you write this as well, because oxygen is what allowed us to be here and to have big brains and to be thinking, I mean, humans and other animals. Why oxygen and why not neon, Mark? Why can't we be neon-dependent creatures? What was it about oxygen, about the characteristic of oxygen that proved so vital for the evolution of, we should say, animals?
Well, that's a great question. It's a great question. And actually, you know, when you write books, you know, you start off intrigued about certain things and wanting to communicate some things and you write it all down. But then you discover things along the way. And that's the beauty and delight of writing. And I have to say, one of the things I really understood by writing this was asking that question. Like, hold on a minute. Okay, so we breathe oxygen, but why? And is it the best gas? And if it isn't the best one, can we have a better one, please? Maybe it is neon. And in order to answer that question, you have to go back to the early Earth. So the early Earth starts to become have a solid crust, cool down enough to have liquid water on its surface. And at some point in that history, there's heat coming from the Earth's core that's causing all sorts of reactions inside on the Earth's crust in the water. Like these geothermal vents are coming up, bubbling up. All sorts of different chemistry is happening. And there's almost no oxygen. Like all the oxygen that was in the atmosphere then, because it's so reactive, has reacted with everything else around and formed rocks. So there's no free oxygen around, almost none. If you're looking for gases to kind of pump prime the evolution of life, the one that's kind of available, well, there's a couple. One's hydrogen sulfide, another one is carbon dioxide. They're around in the early Earth, they're in the water, and they start to get used for the early life. And we don't really know at all how early life formed, but once it did form, it's utilizing carbon dioxide gas. And so no oxygen, carbon dioxide gas. And then at some point in the evolution of that life form, as evolution happens and it finds different niches, there's a set of chemistry that gets established which allows some bacteria to harness energy from the sun, not the geothermal vents, but now from the sun, turn and basically react carbon dioxide and light and create a waste gas, bubble it off, which was oxygen. So it's actually taking oxygen out of the carbon dioxide and it's using the sun's energy to do that. And that's called photosynthesis. And when that happens, the oxygen is so toxic to the other life forms, it starts killing them off. And, you know, we don't quite know how this happened, but at some point, the photosynthesis, you know, bacteria become very, very plentiful and you get this thing called the Great Oxygen Event, where the atmosphere gets just bubbled full of oxygen, that these life forms are thriving so much in the sunshine, they're just bubbling off oxygen. And there's a big extinction event at that time. Lots of things can't cope with that, but it probably pump primes the next stage of evolution, which is that could you harness oxygen? Could life harness oxygen to do something else? And this is the beginning of oxygen life forms which we're the descendants of. And it's not neon life forms. A, because there isn't anything producing neon except for nuclear reactions in the Earth's crust, and so neon's not is not increasing. There's not a big opportunity with neon in terms of the number of neon gases. Secondly, because neon doesn't react with anything, so there's no opportunity to do what life does, which is to create a complex network of chemical reactions which produce something that is able to self-replicate, basically create order and self-replicate. And that's what we do. We basically create a whole body pattern which, you know, allows us to have function, have arms, have legs, have blood chiming through them, have a brain. All of that is a set of chemical reactions at its core, which is allowing those things to happen, be developed in the first place, and then to be maintained, like constantly looking for errors in the system and healing them. All that needs energy, a lot of energy, it turns out. And where do you get that energy from? You need a very reactive gas in order to unlock the energy. And guess what? Oxygen is that gas. So as soon, it's a bit like turbocharging life. As soon as you go from the CO2 as your kind of source of creating this organizing life form to oxygen, you turbocharge living systems, and you go from single cell organisms to multi-cell organisms like ourselves. You get animals, you get plants, you get fungi, and life just absolutely explodes on the planet. And it's absolutely and utterly connected with the evolution of bubbling oxygen up. And the really amazing thing I got from understanding that and really comprehending that is that if you are here in the early solar system and looking at Earth, before oxygen is bubbling up, before that whole event, the great oxygen event, Earth is orange. Earth is not blue-green. Because Earth is kind of got, you know, a few gases that are, you know, mostly giving it a brown oxygen atmosphere. It'll look more like Mars.
Is it iron making it kind of red?
Well, yeah, it's going to have orange-ish? A sort of rocky, mostly rocky, because early Earth has got, you know, just lava and rock and loads of iron, as you say, iron oxide. All it's mopping all the oxygen up. And then it's got a very hazy brown atmosphere. It's got water, but the blue that you see is not there. The green is not there because there's no plants on the Earth. And plants are what? They are chlorophyll, which is the photosynthesis, which is creating the oxygen. So it's really kind of, yeah, an amazing thought, really, that the evolution of oxygen, we co-evolved with this bubbling up of this gas into the atmosphere to make it, well, at some points it ends up as 35% of the Earth's atmosphere. And you get, there's so much oxygen that you get forest fires are breaking out all the time, because the higher the concentration of oxygen, the more likely a fire is to form. And we think there are very big forest fires now, and we've only got 19% oxygen. What if we had 35%? But the other thing that lots of oxygen does is it basically made organisms much bigger. So you have huge insects, and we know that there were dragonflies with wingspans of a meter long. And so, you know, all sorts of different life forms become possible depending on the concentration of oxygen.
When you say that the Earth was not blue-green, but it was during the great oxygen event, that the blue-green was the blue-green algae, but also your wonderful description there of how we came to be oxygen creatures shows that we are as grateful, we should be as grateful to the blue-green algae as we should to the geology of the planet and the temperature of the planet. And this goes back to your earlier point that the two are integrated. Geology allows for the life, and the life feeds back into the geology and the composition of the planet, that they are all one. We think of them as being separate forces.
Yeah, you know, it really is amazing, the idea that these rocks and these enormous continents, you sort of think of them as sort of, yeah, they're kind of completely separate from life. Yeah, completely separate from life. But they're not. They're completely intertwined. The two have evolved together.
Mark Miodovnik, it is so fun to talk to you, and we're really happy to have you back on the show to discuss your newest book, It's a Gas. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure being here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Mark Miodovnik is professor of materials and society at University College London and the author of It's a Gas, the Sublime and Elusive Elements That Expand Our World.
All right, well, Seth, this brings us to the big picture portion of the show. What are your thoughts about gases?
Well, I'm all for gases. The fact that these compounds that are even elements that exist in gaseous form, of course, they also exist in solid form if you, compress them or lower the temperature and so forth. I mean, think of carbon dioxide. You usually think of it as a gas and something that the plants like. But if you cool it way down, you get dry ice, which is useful for, ice cream trucks and stuff like that.
Could you have solid neon?
You could, yeah. At a certain temperature and pressure, you would get solid neon. I don't know why you'd want it, but it might be a good conversation piece.
What's an element that often changes states that we maybe come across quite often?
Well, freon comes to mind. Freon's in your fridge, and, it's the way it works. Freon is, a liquid, but it can absorb heat and turned into a gas, and that's what your fridge does. It's sitting there turning freon from liquid to gas, and when it does so, it takes heat out of its surroundings, and that's what cools down your fridge. One interesting thing that we've learned in the past couple of decades is that if you turn some gases to solids, you might make something that's superconducting. In other words, it can conduct electricity just like a wire can, but there's no resistance, so, there's no loss of energy.
What gas are you thinking of?
Well, an example would be helium. You normally think of helium as a gas, something that's useful for dirigibles and things like that. But if you cool it way down, it becomes a superconducting solid. And now you have this stuff that you can run an electric current through, and there's no, there's no loss. There's no resistance to the flow of the current. And that's kind of useful if you're building, a maglev train.
This show is thanks to the invisible but essential behind-the-scenes talents of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Shannon Rose Geary and Brian Edwards. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley.
Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization that studies life in all its complexity. I'm the Institute's senior astronomer, Seth Shostak, and we want to extend a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters.
Original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science that considers the invisible materials that shape our world is called A Real Gas.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.